the San Francisco Experience podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy, independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 25, Episode 7, The Subplot, What China is Reading and Why It Matters, talking with author Megan Walsh. Hi, Megan, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me.
America's relationship with China is multi-layered. Media coverage takes its cue from Washington as regards the important topics like trade. We have a $750 billion trading relationship. Or economics. China is the largest buyer of U.S. debt. Taiwan, where both sides agree to disagree. And of course, there's the intense competition between the two countries to win hearts and minds around the world. But rarely do we hear about what the average Chinese consumer, student, or worker is reading, thinking, and what new cultural trends predominate. One way to take the pulse of the Chinese public, though, is to look at what they're reading. Our guest today is literary critic Megan Walsh. Fueled by her passionate engagement with Chinese literature and culture, she shows us why it's important to pay attention to Chinese fiction. She joins us from her office in London. Hello, Megan, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Megan, please take a few moments and tell us about yourself and your engagement with China.
So I first lived in China back in 2004, which was mainly sort of traveling and teaching English out there. But when I went to work at, moved to the Times of London when I came back, I ended up writing about various pieces to do with China as a result of having lived there for a little bit. And it was one trip that I was sent on, I think it was in 2012, I was part of a delegation of journalists to go and find out about Chinese literature ahead of the London Book Fair, where there was a kind of a partnership between Chinese and British publishing companies. And so we were there to sort of act as a curtain raiser for the Chinese authors who were coming over. And it was that trip in particular, which I went out there with very specific, I think, you know, ideas about what I thought about Chinese writing. Mm-hmm. And it completely changed my mind once I got there. And I felt quite sheepish about I guess you could call them prejudices that I went out with. Mm-hmm. That became the kernel of my particular interest in Chinese fiction.
And then later on, did you go back to SOAS, the School of Oriental and Asian Studies in London, to get a master's?
That's right. So I moved out to China in 2013, and I came back to do my master's in Chinese literature. And I moved back out to China to do some intensive language learning as part of my master's, and then ended up staying out there a little bit longer. So yes, I also did my master's at SOAS.
Oh, very impressive. Well, Megan, how has China's economic growth affected its writers and fiction? And of course, you have a 20-year perspective from your first trip to China and engagement with the Chinese publishing industry and Chinese writers and Chinese fiction. How has China's economic growth that you've witnessed over the last 20 years impacted its writers and fiction?
Yeah, it's a huge question, mainly because I think, as we all know, the period of economic uplift has been so brief in relative terms, sort of enormous transformation of the country. And I think writers in particular have really struggled to keep up with the pace of change, but have also found themselves very well placed to do it compared to maybe writers in other countries where things have happened at a slightly slower rate in terms of a kind of industrial revolution. So what you had in the 70s and 80s was a flourishing of all sorts of different genres, you know, once the restrictions had been lifted, and the priority was growing the economy. So mm-hmm. people were able to write about things they hadn't been able to write about before. It was a kind of flooding, a parched area. But then I think, you know, as is the way with China's particular government, the CCP has been in power this whole time. So despite all these huge changes, that the people in power have remained the same. And it's often referred to as the weather, the system of sort of governments and censorship in terms of the arts has really fluctuated wildly. So obviously around the time of Tiananmen, things really cracked down again. And what you had really was this strange combination of economic uplift, but political restraint, mm-hmm. and it created a very strange new set of genres of fiction, which I don't think have really popped up anywhere else in the world.
I can imagine, of course, here in the West, whether it's British fiction, American fiction, or fiction from other countries that's translated, pretty free to say what we want to say, or the writer is free to say what they want to say and write about. I noticed that in your book, Subplot, you talk about the use of metaphor. Now, I guess all fiction writers use metaphor at some point or another, but tell us about some of the genres, some of the plotting, and that because of this odd political control that exists in China, that maybe the use of metaphor in the context of fiction is more predominant than it might be in the West. That's just my thought.
I mean, I think it seems to mostly predominate with the writers who had some experience of the Mao years. They were writers who were born in the 50s and 60s, many of whom, especially, there are two very sort of noted writers. One is Mo Yan, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2012, and Yan Liangke. And they were both writers for the People's Liberation Army, propaganda writers. So they had this sort of intimate understanding of how these narratives were constructed and what was expected of writers in order to tell a certain, or put forward a certain message. And both of them, in their, you know, quite distinctive ways, have utilized these skills to obliquely critique that particular time. They still write about the past. They still write about events that can only really be touched on obliquely, and that's the sort of special use of metaphor for them, I think. Obviously, metaphors are still something that censors worry about, but I think with the diminished, I guess, power of literature compared to those times, in the sort of 70s and 80s, it was still incredibly powerful. Now we have mobile phones, TV, it's a bit less dodgy, so people aren't so worried. I think the censors aren't so worried about metaphor as a way to critique the government. So it's also being sort of used a little bit less. But, you know, I guess the main one was that I write about is this sort of sense of people being caught in some kind of limbo, mm-hmm. That they cannot reconcile how the past has become the present. And all of them seem to write about that in very interesting and unique ways.
How did Chinese writers go about getting their books published in China? Now, of course, we have to recognize that it's a state-controlled publishing industry. Is there a central organ where you present your book, it gets approved and then published? How does that work? How does publishing in China work?
Yeah, so it changes its name every now and again. I think it's currently known as the GAPP. I can't remember quite what it stands for. But it's a body that publishers must, I guess, be authorized by in order to get a certain, I forget what it's called now, you know, kind of printing number, an official number that means it's allowed to be published in China. And so I guess the sort of broad understanding is that, you know, writers have freedom to write, but publishers don't. Mm-hmm. And it's the publishers really who have to be extra careful. They're the ones who suffer the consequences a lot of the time for publishing things that might be considered inappropriate or critical of the mm-hmm. government in some way. So traditionally, they're the sort of gatekeeper, and then there's the Chinese Writers Association, which is more of a kind of boys' club where people, most writers are members of it in some way, not through an act of complicity, but just because it makes life easier. And they have sort of upheld the norm since the 1940s. But I think the arrival of the internet completely threw the cat amongst the pigeons in that respect. And, you know, people published whatever they wanted for a very long time. I guess made these old, busty organizations feel a bit redundant. That isn't until recently, but mm-hmm. I can come on to that if you're interested.
Sure. I'm just curious. Now, just coming back to translation of Chinese fiction writers into English or other languages, how do they go about that? Is that officially sanctioned? In order for Western readers to read Chinese fiction, obviously it has to be translated. Very few of us are going to read it in the original Chinese. How do Chinese writers go about getting their works translated into English or other languages?
I guess something that's worth mentioning is that for a lot of writers, especially the likes of Yan Liangke and slightly more controversial writers, they often only publish their work in translation, that they're able to, you know, write and carry on teaching even in in China, but they, well, actually, that's not strictly true. They can publish in Taiwan and Hong Kong until recently anyway, Taiwan still. So often these quite controversial writers are quite attractive to Western publishers for that very reason. And so there is automatically some kind of, I said, impetus, I think, to publish those works and to translate them. But I would also say, for all the reasons that you mentioned in your introduction, so many people are now interested in China, and there are just a huge number of young people who are learning Chinese and very keen to translate stuff. So I think they're also on the ground looking for interesting things to translate, finding ways to build relationships with Chinese authors for that reason.
Is online publishing a big business in China? Are most books available online? You talk about online publishing in your book.
Yes. So because there has been this very strict publishing system in China, and also obviously under Mao, there was basically no literature at all apart from a couple of things, mainly things he wrote. It created a sort of vacuum for the post-Mao years, and that was initially flooded by these sort of very innovative genres, but the main thing that has happened is the internet has filled that gap, specifically for young people for whom there's been no literature really about things of young and urban, living in a city, being a teenager, going to school, university, buying nice clothes. And so the internet filled that, created that, or sort of created an opportunity to fill that vacuum. And it's created, I think, the largest internet publishing industry in the world by far. I think there's 500 million active readers, 20 million writers, 26 million titles. I think the industry is estimated to be worth something like $4.4 billion. Mm. It's just unparalleled. Whereas here, we still like to read books. We're still used to having hard copies of things. And I think in China, it's almost all books are now read online, and much of them are also just produced without editors, without publishers getting involved online also.
So by publishing online, are they getting around GAPP?
Yeah, they have been. I mean, I think in the early days, it was an opportunity to write freely, but those things sort of had disappeared by about 2012, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. And then it was just flooded with, YA novels, essentially. Some of them are, 6 million words long. People are writing 10,000, 20,000 words a day. I can imagine that the quality is terrible, but it created this, I've sort of seen it referred to as a culture of prosumers, the producers and the consumers are the same people in a way, and there's a very active reading community and things. And it really quickly became something that tech companies wanted to monetize, to harness. So they now have a kind of pay-per-view structure in which popularity is all that matters. Yeah, it's making a lot of money. People sort of are just desperate to get their sort of precious IP bought and turned into a drama or whatever. But yes, it did somehow get around the GAPP because they thought it was sort of nonsense and not worth worrying about. But I think they're now terrified that it's all, the nonsense is the problem, that people are just now engaging with nonsense.
Now, in your book, you talk about some of the genres that are popular. You talked about crime genres, science fiction. Tell us about those genres. How popular are they, and how do they differ from, say, the crime or science fiction genre that we're used to here in the West in our fiction?
Crime, as you can imagine, is, and by extension, corruption, is a very difficult thing to write about in a country where, I think, I can't remember when it was. I think, again, 2012, they said that there were no unsolved crimes in China. And there was a sort of sense that there was this, sort of martial arts move by the government whereby they were sort of encouraging people to write about Chinese crime as something that they have sort of solved themselves. Like, thank goodness that the CCP has solved crime in China. And I think, before 2004, corruption was banned on being depicted on TV, but suddenly there was this amazing, it was a phenomenon, it wasn't an amazing novel per se, but it's called In the Name of the People. It was an online novel that was about policemen getting corrupt officials. And it was really cheesy and not very good, but I think people really, it was a sort of cathartic experience for a lot of viewers seeing corruption addressed on TV. And it was hailed as this kind of amazing moment in, I guess, sort of, you know, Chinese TV, that people are able to sort of watch this sort of thing. Uh-huh. But what really happens is people just, most crime writers have to kind of be a bit like a pilot fish and fly completely sort of unnoticed under the radar, as if they are spinning exactly what the government wants in order to tell their crime stories. Most people are used to reading between the lines and sort of see that there's, it's much more complicated than that.
What about science fiction? What about Chinese science fiction?
Yeah, so science fiction is a genuinely exciting genre at the moment in China. And you've probably heard of Liu Cixin, who's this, I guess he's the first Chinese writer to truly cross from China to sort of Western markets without any kind of, I don't know, questioning really.
What is his name again?
It's the Three Body Problem trilogy. And Barack Obama famously put it on his reading list 1 year and said it helped him sort of put things in perspective. It's about aliens trying to destroy the Earth. And it's absolutely, I mean, it's brilliant. He's a very kind of innovative and exciting writer, but he also represents, I think, something very different to sci-fi in the UK and America, and perhaps in Europe. I'm less familiar with that. There's a real sense of optimism about science and technology. It's not treated as a sort of dystopian force in our near and distant future. It's seen as something that's treated either dispassionately, something just to sort of experiment with, or something that could genuinely revolutionize both humanity and the sort of post-human world. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it quite uniquely different, I think. And I think that the main sort of idea is that in China, technology is not associated with bad things yet. It's associated with this time of sort of epic change and economic transformation.
Are there other genres such as romance or historical novels that are also popular in China?
Oh, yeah. So historical novels have always been huge, and they've sort of been turned into these sort of epic TV shows, and they're always very popular. Romance is also, in recent years, extremely popular. It was banned under Mao, and I think young female writers especially are making up for lost time. And you can't move for romance, I would say, now. It's probably, much like in the West, you know, the most sort of lucrative genre in China.
I noticed there was an interesting stat in your book. You mentioned that that fiction writing is about 7% of the total market, but that self-help books are 33% of the market. And I was surprised by that self-help number at 33%. Here in the United States, self-help books are about 6% of the market. So tell us about self-help books in China. Why are the Chinese so interested in self-help?
It's a really good question, and I can only give my view. I'm not entirely sure, but I think there has been a real emphasis on pragmatism in the last sort of 30, 40 years, that this time has to be capitalized on, that this is not the time for poetry. This is not the time for writing about feelings or, you know, engaging with art, so not non-pragmatic subjects. Mm-hmm. And I heard about people sort of talking about the idea that there is no reading for pleasure. You know, you don't read for pleasure, you read for advancement, or you read to learn more, or you learn to. And I think that has been sort of quite instilled in people for a long time, that they can't, they feel like they can't waste their time on things that don't have an obvious purpose, I guess. Obviously, that's not true, and my book was an attempt to also try and show the ways in which people are really doing the opposite to that. But it's the sort of the brute pragmatism of the times that has made self-help books just sort of desperately popular. Mm-hmm. And I think we have sort of put it in the context of there just being nothing really before 1970.
In your book, you talk about migrant worker poetry and migrant worker writings on the internet, and you said that you're quite taken by this. It's a form, a genre, if you will, that of course doesn't exist here in the West. Tell us about that and what captivated you about that.
Yeah, so it's again back to the idea that China has gone through essentially this sort of industrial revolution at a time where there was the internet, which has given these young workers a chance to publish their own poetry, their own stories. So it's inadvertently created, you know, one of the largest working class literary movements in history. But what's distinctive about it is that while their jobs have made them sort of leave their homes, there's 300 million, estimated 300 million migrant workers in various cities, although that's probably changing now. Their work is entirely about self-erasure, their bodies being used for the sort of the construction of the new China. Mm-hmm. And a lot of their poems and their stories are just a way of trying to deal with that feeling. And as a result, they're incredibly beautiful. I think a lot of the other stuff, the other fiction you read, especially by people of that age, is quite sort of, it's written in bad faith. You know, it's about trying to make money, or it's trying to replicate something else they've read in order to get more clicks. And I think these young people are channeling the classics of Chinese poetry, as well as just trying to sort of sublimate the hardship that they feel on production lines into lines of poetry, essentially. And there's I guess the most famous poet is called Xu Lijie, and he died by suicide back in 2014. But his poems are just stunning, and he really did draw attention to the plight of these young workers who, you know, might have been foregrounded by the communist revolution back in the day, but have been completely sort of forgotten in the contemporary setting. And it really is very captivating to read.
Well, Megan, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what specific Chinese writers who are translated into English would you recommend to our listeners to read to get a better sense of what Chinese readers are reading and what motivates China's current political environment and cultural environment?
So perhaps unhelpfully, I would recommend my gateway drug, which was Eileen Chang, who was a writer in the 30s mainly. She's so good, and she is still loved by readers now, and I think she's a brilliant introduction to how brilliant Chinese fiction can be. But in terms of sort of contemporary works, I would highly recommend people read Iron Moon, which is a translation of a lot of this migrant worker poetry. It's translated by Eleanor Goodman, and it's a very good introduction to what people are writing. I think anything translated by Ken Liu for science fiction is a brilliant way to start understanding Chinese science fiction as well. You know, it's a brilliant and alternative view of our own future, I think.
Mm-hmm. Are you working on any other China-related literary projects at this point?
I'm actually not. I just had a baby, well, a year ago. So,
oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So she slowed me down a little bit, but I'm very interested in the role of the humanities within the Chinese cultural sphere, and also seeing that through the prism of writers who have left China and then choose to write in English and not in Chinese, or when they come to America or the UK, other European countries, and decide to study literature there rather than in China. So I would say that's sort of broadly an area of interest that I have at the moment, but I'm just in the process of researching it at the moment rather than any coherent plan.
And where can our listeners buy a copy of your book, The Subplot, What China is Reading and Why It Matters?
I think all the usual places, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, I think still have some copies. But yeah, Amazon is probably, unfortunately, the easiest place.
I see. And how can our listeners follow you?
Mainly, actually, through my website, which is meganwalsh.co.uk. I am off social media, which is, I know, sacrilege these days, but I've disavowed it for a little while. But you can find all sorts of information there.
Oh, okay. I'm just curious, you disavowed social media. Was this sort of like a Lenten fast or something, or something longer?
No, I think I've actually never been on it. I find it too distracting, and I'd rather be focusing on other things. Although I do, obviously, when I'm researching things, look on social media, but I find it too distracting.
Okay. Well, once again, I'd like to thank you, Megan, for joining us and shedding light on this fascinating subject of Chinese fiction and how it has grown along with China bursting on the seams economically and with its political power. Cultural power follows that great expansion of wealth. And you've given us some good names here of authors that we can follow up on and read in translation so that we as readers in the West can get a sense of what Chinese authors are sharing with their readers and what readers are clamoring to hear. So thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for our listeners, today's episode is number 494. Listen to us on Apple Podcast, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms in total, with listeners in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast. And this has been Jim Herlihy for the San Francisco Experience podcast, coming to you from San Francisco.